Everybody recognize that? It's a $20 bill, right? How do you know it's real? Could be counterfeit. In fact, frequently I've gone into a store and I've given my $20 bill to merchants, and they will take it and they'll bring out a special pen and they'll mark on it. Or they'll hold it up to the light and look at it. You ever seen people do that with your 20s? That's what I thought. Good. I thought I was the only one that looked suspicious. but how can you tell the original from the counterfeit? They're pretty close. And according to the State Department, it's getting harder and harder to tell the original from a counterfeit. Last year, the United States government, I'm going to put this back in my pocket, recouped more than $88 million in counterfeit currency in the United States last year. $88 million. And more than half of it was made on regular old inkjet and laser printers, the kind that you and I have in our studies. While the counterfeiting business used to be specialized, these days it's easy for anyone with a printer to give it a try. And that's exactly what's happened in these United States of America. Bloomberg reported, statistics highlight the growth of this industry. In 1995, less than 1% of fake bills were produced on digital printers. But in the last fiscal year, almost 60% of that $88.7 million in counterfeit currency that was recovered by the U.S. State Department was created using inkjet and laser printers. Of course, we all know counterfeit currency has a long history in the United States. During the Civil War, one-third of all money in U.S. circulation was counterfeit. That's why the Secret Service Department of the Treasury was created. The agency was established in 1865 as a response to widespread counterfeiting. Now, you may be interested to know that in our economy of nearly $300 billion a year, only 0.03% is counterfeit. I mean, $88 million sounds like a lot to me, but it's still such a small percentage compared to what it was during the Civil War. It says, this report, that even a bigger counterfeit industry, though, is operating in these United States. Counterfeit products may cost the global economy up to $250 billion, not million, billion dollars a year, according to estimates from the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, known as the AECD. Millions of those shipments enter the United States every year. While government agencies do their best to crack down on counterfeit goods, they only manage to catch a fraction of the fake products that enter the United States every year. Still, the U.S. Customs and Border Protection values that seized a fraction of these staggering amounts. The value of counterfeit goods seized rose by 39%. In 2013, from $1.2 billion in 2012. Based on the manufacturer's suggested retail price of the genuine versions of the counterfeit goods, some of the most valuable imitations were handbags, wallets, watches and jewelry, and consumer electronics. This counterfeit industry costs us billions of dollars every year. But the biggest counterfeit and the longest of all is the counterfeit of worship. That is what I will talk about today, counterfeit worship. As Mr. Plagenza mentioned as my title, counterfeit worship. For those of us in God's church, we have just completed the fall holy days. And now we have our sights set on the spring festivals. But I think you will agree with me, it's a long, dry spell, the next 5.5 months until those festivals arrive. These begin an annual cycle of festivals that do what? What do God's holy days do for us? I think you all know the answer. Of course, they remind and rehearse the step-by-step progression of God's plan, don't they? We know God's plan for mankind through the progression of God's 7 annual holy days. Well, by contrast, what do the religious celebrations of our culture teach about God's progressive plan? Nothing. Zip. Nada. Zero. They teach nothing about God's great plan for mankind. They really have no value except tradition and custom. Just like a fake 20. Just like a counterfeit handbag. I've got to confess to you that one of my daughter's weaknesses is handbags. And I traveled to, I discovered this shortly after Linda and I got married, and our daughter was a teenager, and she was saying, I have to have one of these handbags. I've got to have a Coach bag. I don't know if any of you have ever been to the Coach store, but they're very expensive. And I'm confessing to you a weakness that I don't want to go beyond this room. But I had the opportunity to go to Thailand, and I visited Bangkok, and then a town in the north called Chiang Mai. Some of you have been there. I see you nodding your head. And you'll know in Chiang Mai, those of you who have been there, they have something called the Midnight Market. And you go there after you have a late dinner, and it goes until 1 or 2 in the morning. And it's basically a big flea market. They cut off several streets, and it's pedestrian traffic only. They set up their kiosks, and you can walk through the Midnight Market. And let me tell you, you can buy just about anything you want in Chiang Mai's Midnight Market. It's fantastic. I love bargaining, and I love markets like that. And I was walking through the market, and I came upon this one merchant who had these beautiful Coach bags. Not just Coach, but all the latest bags. And, of course, I asked him how much they were. When he told me the price, I knew they were fakes. Right? I said, where are they made? China. He was honest with me. They're made in China. And I saw them, and I remember seeing the look in my daughter's eyes. I need a Coach bag. So he had a large suitcase there. I said, how much is the suitcase? $10. I said, I'll give you $5 for it. Okay. So I bought the suitcase, and then I purchased a number of these bags. In fact, I filled the suitcase with bags for my daughter. And I brought those bags with me and gave them to my daughter, and her eyes lit up, and she was so happy. And I said, now they're knockoffs. They're not real. That's fine. They look like the real McCoys. They're okay with me. And she shared those bags with all of her friends. And so at church, all these high school girls are walking around with these expensive bags on their arms, and they're just as happy as they can be. And, of course, Dad's happy. Little did I know until I read this article that I was contributing towards the counterfeit industry in the United States by bringing in these bags. I guess if I would have been caught by the Customs Department, I'd be in big trouble. But I had no idea at the time. So I sinned in ignorance, please. So that's for the record. I brought all these counterfeit things back for my daughter, and she was very happy. Just like this world is blissfully happy with their counterfeit, right? As we all know, and we all probably witness tonight. To one degree or another. Let's go to Mark 7. I'd like to begin here. Mark chapter 7. Notice what Christ said. And he wasn't saying it to just the Jews. He actually was quoting Isaiah the prophet, who was prophesying to all of Israel. But I think we all know these celebrations, particularly those that are coming in this drought of holy days between now and the spring, are counterfeits. Facsimiles of the real thing. Notice what Christ says in Mark 7, verse 6. Mark 7, verses 6 through 8. In Mark 7, verse 6, Christ says, "He answered and said to them, 'Well did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites. As it is written, these people honors me with their lips.'" Last time I took a flight in an airplane, there was an article about Christmas. I thought it was interesting. So I opened it up and I began reading. And the author of the book, or the article in the magazine, went through step by step about how Christmas existed a long time before Christianity. Many of the customs we use today come from all kinds of different non-Christian religions from Europe, Asia, all mixed together. And at the end of the article, he says, "But it's okay because we now put Christ's name on it." It's okay because we put Christ's name on it. And so much of what we do today, if we put a Christian tag on it, if you've got a counterfeit but you could have put a Coach sticker on it, it looks like the real McCoy to some people, right? Uneducated people. But we're not uneducated, are we? Mark chapter 7, verse 6. "This people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. And in vain they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men." For laying aside, in verse 8, the commandment of God, you hold the tradition of men. Now we know in the context of this that Christ is talking to these self-righteous Jews that he encountered many times. But of course, as I said, he took the quote from the prophet Isaiah, who was giving a general prophecy to the nation of Israel. I think the words here are very clear to us in the context of what I'm talking about today, counterfeit worship. Just because you put a label on it does not make it the real McCoy. It's still a counterfeit. Let's go back to Deuteronomy 12. Deuteronomy chapter 12. And verse 28. Deuteronomy 12:28. We read here a warning that God gave ancient Israel. He said in verse 28, "Observe and obey all these words." And we know that Moses spent a great deal of time with God. God taught Moses. God instructed Moses. He told him exactly what should be passed on to the ancient Israelites. "Observe and obey all these words which I command you, that it may go well with you and your children after you forever, when you do what is good and right in the sight of the Lord." Verse 28, it comes with a footnote, or verse 29 rather, "When the Lord your God cuts off from before you the nations which you go to dispossess, and you displace them and dwell in their land, take heed to yourself that you do not be ensnared to follow after them, after they are destroyed from before you, and that you do not inquire after their gods, saying, 'How did these nations serve their gods? I also will do likewise.'" The warning is very clear in Scripture. Don't follow counterfeit worship practices. From the very beginning, when God was dealing with his people, it was very clear what he wanted. Let's drop down to verse 32. "Whatever I command you, be careful to observe it. You shall not add to it, nor take away from it." It's pretty clear. Don't take the counterfeit and say, "Well, we're just going to say it's Christian, or we're going to say it's about Christ, or we're going to say it's about the church, or we're going to say it's about love." That's adding to it very clearly. "You shall not add to it, nor take away from it." Again, I think the scriptures are pretty clear, are they not? Let's go back to verse 31. "You shall not worship the Lord your God in that way." For every abomination to the Lord, which he hates, they have done to their gods. For they burn even their sons and their daughters in the fire to their gods, passing through the fire and literally sacrificing their children in the form of human sacrifice to their gods. Clearly, when the Israelites went into the promised land, they were not to practice or follow the practices, the counterfeit practices of worship of these nations before them. If there's something God hates, we shouldn't minimize it, should we? He says in verse 31, every abomination. And believe you me, when you dig deep into these topics, you find that they are truly abominations. And many people will say today, well, yeah, but we don't do that. You know, we don't make our children pass through the fire. We don't sacrifice human beings. We don't even sacrifice animals. And yet, of course, I don't know about you, but I still remember when I was 5 years old and I found out that my grandparents had been lying to me about Christmas and Santa Claus. Remember that? Traumatized me, because that was about the same time my parents found out about the truth. You mean Santa is not really Santa? He's Grandpa? You know, dressed up in that red coat? You mean he can't really get down a chimney? You mean he really doesn't travel around and give kids all around the world toys? The lies we tell our children for the first 5 years of their lives? Certainly built upon a weak foundation, these counterfeits, aren't they? When you look at the annual calendar of popular traditions in our Western world, it at first appears like it's a random set of days, collected here, there, and kind of put together on the calendar. The celebrations seem to be sprinkled through the year for convenience, sometimes with the seasons. But when we take a closer look, we begin to see some common threads running through them. A system of worshiping false gods starting shortly after the flood. A counterfeit perversion of Jesus Christ as God, his arrival on the earth in the flesh, his death, his resurrection from the dead, a denial of his saving the world. There is a total obscuring of God's plan through the counterfeit religious system of today, when you look very closely at it. So what I want to cover today are the roots of the false worship or counterfeit worship system. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 10. Genesis chapter 10. I have a handout for you that I'm going to have distributed in just a moment. It's in my briefcase there, Linda. Would you retrieve those handouts, please? While you're turning to Genesis 10, verse 1. And I will ask maybe Bob to distribute those in just a moment. Not just yet, but let's go to Genesis 10 first, verse 1. Now this is the genealogy of the sons of Noah, immediately following the flood, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And sons were born to them following the flood. Drop down to verse 6. The sons of Ham were Cush, Mitzrayim, Put, and Canaan. Down to verse 8. And Cush begat Nimrod. And he began to be a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore it is said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. Again, reading it in the New King James and even the King James, it can be a little confusing. For sure. It's kind of interesting. The word here, before the Lord, is translated variously against, anger, face, forefront, front, in combination with other words. The idea is it was in the face of God, in God's face, instead of just before God. It was like, this is in your face. From the Brown Driver Briggs Hebrew dictionary, Nimrod means rebellion or the valiant one. Guzik's commentary says, Cush begat Nimrod. One son of Cush worthy of note is Nimrod. He was a mighty one on the earth, but not in a good way, according to the original Hebrew. He ruled over Babel, which was the first organized rebellion of human beings against God. The name Nimrod itself means let us rebel. Like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord, the context shows that this is not a compliment of Nimrod. The idea is that Nimrod was an offense before the face of God. The Jerusalem Targum says this, He was powerful in hunting and in wickedness before the Lord, for he was a hunter of the sons of men, not just a hunter of animals. And he said to them, Depart from the judgment of the Lord and adhere to the judgment of Nimrod. Therefore it is said, As Nimrod the strong one, strong in hunting and in wickedness before the Lord. It is interesting that Noah was still alive at this time. And of course we know from 2 Peter 2 and verse 5 that Noah was called a righteous preacher. I cannot imagine that Nimrod would have escaped his preaching. Well, more about Nimrod while we pass out that handout. While the handout is being distributed to you, Nimrod and his mother, Semiramis, in Babylonian mythology, is found in historical sources outside the Bible. It's not our purpose, of course, today to document all those sources, but rather to give a brief glimpse of the foundation of many of today's mainstream counterfeit observances. What I'd like to do in the remainder of the sermon is to go through each of these. I've given you some general history in the form of an article written by Mr. Paul Lukey. This was published in the Ministerial Journal not too long ago, last spring. It's called The Story of Counterfeit Festivals. And I think it's pretty interesting. And I sent an email to Mr. Lukey. He gave me permission to use this today. And I'm giving him credit. So if you have any complaints, contact Mr. Lukey. But what I would really like you to notice is the wheel on the back of the handout. This is commonly called the pagan wheel because it chronicles the pagan festivals that centered around the sun. And the observance of these festivals focus on the sun or the sun god, whom Nimrod was the author of, and Semiramis, his mother, and later his wife. And they had a child, Horus, in mythology, who was the promised son, who was supposedly immaculately conceived. And of course, many religions today have the mother-child as gods. Many religions that predate Christianity. It's kind of interesting. You can go to the ancient religions of the Far East and you will find many examples of the mother-child going back to Mother Earth, going back to Semiramis, and her supernaturally born child. And of course, it was easy for the Romans then to attach many of this symbology to the worship of Mary, the mother of Christ, and Christ as the immaculately conceived one that came in the form of the sun god on December the 25th. But I'm getting way ahead of the story. Let's notice here this wheel of the festivals. And notice it's interesting, there are eight festivals in the pagan wheel of festivals. Satan always has to try to outdo God. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to begin at the top, 12 o'clock, if you will, with the Yule. The Yule is the winter solstice, normally occurring on December the 21st. Of course, this is symbolic of the mother goddess giving a rebirth to the sun god, who now lives again. When Nimrod was killed, according to Jewish tradition, when he was 40, the mother goddess, Semiramis, his mother, wife, was pregnant, and she gave birth miraculously not too long after he died, and she claimed that he was the rebirth of Nimrod. And he was born during the time of the winter solstice. In fact, specifically, the pagan calendar says January the 6th. And, of course, in many countries today, the winter solstice is celebrated for 2 weeks and culminates on January 5th or 6th. If you go to South America, Central America, they often have this as a more dramatic day on their calendar than even December 25th. It's the first part of January. It begins with the Yule. Okay, let's go to Jeremiah chapter 10 and verse 3. Jeremiah 10, 3. The prophet Jeremiah chronicles here some of this counterfeit worship that took place. And the prophet was basically saying in this chapter, and many of us have read Jeremiah 10, so I don't need to go through the whole chapter, but he's basically saying, look, you guys have adopted some of these pagan or counterfeit religious practices that God said don't do. And, of course, he said part of the reason you're going to go into captivity is because you've done this. Let's drop down to verse 3. Jeremiah 10, verse 3. But the customs of the people are futile. For one cuts a tree from the forest, the work of the hands of the workman with an axe. They decorate it with silver and gold. They fasten it with nails and hammers so that it will not topple. They are upright like a palm tree, and they cannot speak. They must be carried because they cannot go by themselves. But he says, look, there's nothing to fear in what they do, except, of course, offending God, because these icons can really do nothing to you or for you. It's a facsimile. It's a fake of the original. Now, many commentaries will tell you this is probably not talking about the Christmas tree. It's talking about a tree that's cut down and carved and then covered in gold and silver. It became an icon. But, of course, if you cut down any tree and worship it, it becomes a symbol of worship. And what we have here is a description, if you will, of the Yule, the son born to Semiramis, called Horus or Tammuz, was a reincarnation of Nimrod, and his symbol was the green tree, the new green tree that sprouted from the fallen big tree, if you will. And, of course, that occurred during the time of the winter solstice. Again, it's not my purpose today to go through all the trimmings of Christmas. We can maybe do that either next year or later this year. Let's next go to 1 o'clock. The embolic or the candle mass. February 2nd. This is when the sun god's strength is now growing. Sun god is maturing and growing. And, of course, remember, these days are focused on the sun. How is it that God's days are determined on the sacred Hebrew calendar? By the moon, right? Primarily based on the moon. That, too, is an antithetical of the real, that is the counterfeit. Looking ahead to the end of winter and the beginning of new life, this symbolic phase lasts. Says some say a snake emerged from the womb of Semiramis to test the weather. Later traditions in other countries have a snake emerging from its hole in the ground or a badger. Today, what do we have emerging from the ground about this time of the year to see if he can see his own shadow? Ah, very good. Groundhog. Again, just a facsimile or a counterfeit of something that goes back a long time. Also about this time, we have something called Valentine's Day, don't we? February the 14th. If you'll look down below at the little heart in the footnotes, there's a note there about Valentine's Day. Now, I'm not going to read that footnote or any other material. You can read that on your own. But it's kind of interesting. The silhouette of Cupid is probably the most famous infant in the world. Right? With the exception of perhaps Christ. Well, why does the baby have a bow and arrows and wings? Have you thought about that? I'd like to quote from an article from the Good News magazine in 1985. St. Valentine's Day, as a lover's festival, it is the choice of a Valentine in the modern development of sending Valentine cards. It has no relation to the saint or to any incident in his life, according to the Encyclopedia Britannica. When Constantine in AD 313 made Christianity an official religion of the Roman Empire, there was some talk in church circles of discarding this pagan free-for-all, which it turned out to be. But the Roman citizens wouldn't hear of it. So it was agreed that the holiday would become as it was, except for the more grossly sexual observances. It was not until the reign of Pope Gelasius that the holiday became a Christian custom. As far back as 496, Pope Gelasius changed Lupercalia on February 15th to St. Valentine's Day on the 14th. Did you know that centuries before the birth of Jesus, the Romans celebrated February 15th and the evening of the 14th as an idolatrous, sensuous festival in honor of one called Lupercus, the hunter of wolves? The Romans called the festival the Lupercalia. The custom of exchanging valentines and all the other traditions in honor of Lupercus, the defiled hero hunter of Rome. The Persian author Rashid al-Din, in his History of the Franks, mentions that Nimrod extended his hunting expeditions even as far as Italy. The Apennine Mountains of Italy also bore the name of the Mountains of Nimrod. The hunter Nimrod pursued wolves in the Appian Alps, or mountains, of Italy and acquired the title Lupercus, or Wolf Hunter. So Valentine's Day was originally a day set aside by the pagan Romans in honor of, who else? Nimrod. A lot of it focuses here where we read from Genesis chapter 10. But why should Nimrod have been called Valentine by the Romans? And why should the celebration of this day have been anciently limited to the city of Rome before Pope Gelasius' time? What part did the site of ancient Rome play in the life of Nimrod? Valentine comes from the Latin word Valentinius, a proper name derived from the word valens, meaning the strong one or the mighty one. So it was the custom of antiquity for the mother of the male child to present herself for the purification on the 40th day after the day of birth. In the 40th day after January 6th, Nimrod's original birthday takes us to February 15th, the celebration of which began on the evening of February 14th, the Lupercalia, or St. Valentine's Day today. So on this day in February, Semiramis, the mother of Nimrod, was said to have been purified and to have appeared for the first time in public with her son as the original mother and child. On the Roman month of February, in fact, derives its name from the Februa, which the Roman priests used in the rite celebrated on the Lupercalia. The Februa were thongs from the skins of sacrificial animals used in rites of purification on the evening of February the 14th. So we sometimes see what appears to be an innocent, kind of disconnected festival today. And yet we find it's very closely tied to this circle of counterfeit days. Let's go to Isaiah 14. Isaiah 14. And verse 12. Isaiah 14, verse 12. (Clears And remember, I ask, why does Cupid have such a sweet look? Why does he have arrows and a bow? Why does he have wings? Who has wings in the Bible? Who sends out fiery darts of thought to other people? And who would like us to think of him as a cute, sweet, innocent child? No less than the great deceiver himself, Satan the devil. Notice here in Isaiah 14, verse 12. How you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning. How you are cut down to the ground, you who weaken the nations. For you have said in your heart, I will ascend unto heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will also sit on the mount of the congregation on the farthest slopes of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. It is Satan's goal to be worshipped. So he personifies himself in this circle of counterfeit in a number of different forms so that he can be worshipped. In the form of baby Jesus, in the form of the Cupid of Valentine. Let's go to the next one here. The Astara. Spring equinox on March 20th. All you have to do is Google search Easter plus pagan. You will get 3.48 million results in 0.6 seconds if you have a good computer. There is an abundance of facts available in secular history that is more than enough to confirm that Easter is 100% counterfeit and pagan. There's no doubt about it. It's kind of interesting on many of the pagan wheels of observance based on the sun. The compass is also superimposed, making Easter the East. So if you look here at 3 o'clock, Easter, East, which is kind of interesting and ties together. You can see the footnote. Let's go to Ezekiel chapter 8. Ezekiel chapter 8 and verse 13. Ezekiel 8, 13. And he said to me, turn again, and you will see greater abominations than that they are doing. So the prophet Ezekiel was brought into the temple on the Temple Mount. And he said, look, I want you to look at what Israel's doing now. Verse 14, so he brought me to the door of the north gate of the Lord's house. And to my dismay, women were sitting there weeping for Tammuz. Again, all you have to do is Google search Tammuz and you'll find out that this is a name associated with Nimrod, and particularly Nimrod's son through Semiramis, the one who was supernaturally born. Alexander Hislop, in his book, The Two Babylons, says this under the section entitled Easter. The 40 days abstinence of Lent was directly borrowed from the worshippers of the Babylonian goddess. Such a Lent for 40 days in the spring of the year is still observed by the Yazidis, or devil worshippers, of Kurdistan. They have inherited from the very early masters, the Babylonians. Such a Lent of 40 days was held in the spring by the Mexicans. For thus we read in Humboldt, where he gives account of the Mexican observances. Quote, 3 days after the vernal equinox began a solemn fast for 40 days in honor of the sun. Unquote. Such a Lent of 40 days was observed in Egypt, as may be seen on consulting Wilkinson's Egyptians. This Egypt Lent for 40 days, we are informed by Landseer in his book, Sabaean Researches, was held expressly in commemoration of Adonis or Osiris, the great mediatorial god. Let's go back to Ezekiel 8, drop down to verse 15. Then he told me, verse 15, Ezekiel 8, "Have you seen this, O son of man? Turn again and you will see greater abominations than these." So he brought me into the inner court of the Lord's house, and there at the door of the temple of the Lord, between the porch and the altar, were about 25 men with their backs toward the temple of the Lord and their faces toward the east. They were worshiping the sun toward the east. What is it that so many Christians do today? Easter morning sunrise service. Again, we go back to Ezekiel. This practice is a counterfeit of the real resurrection of Jesus Christ. It was celebrated a long time before Christ ever came to this earth, according to what the prophet Ezekiel says. Let's continue by going to Jeremiah 7. Jeremiah chapter 7, verse 17. Jeremiah 7, verse 17. We're still at 3 o'clock on our wheel. Jeremiah 7, verse 17, we read, "Do you not see what they have in the streets or the cities of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem?" Verse 18 now, Jeremiah 7, "The children gather wood, the fathers kindle the fire, the women knead dough to make cakes for the Queen of Heaven. And they pour out drink offerings to other gods, that they may provoke me to anger." A drink offering, of course, was another way of saying a drunken orgy. Now, let me ask you, many of you have been around a while, what generally happens on the observance of these holidays that we've gone through so far? What's the common thread? Heavy drinking, is it not? And we all know what goes hand in hand with heavy drinking and the drop of inhibitions. And what naturally follows, of course, is adultery and fornication. God says that they may provoke me to anger at the end of verse 18. Now, verse 19. "Do they provoke me to anger, says the Lord? Do they not provoke themselves to the shame of their own faces? Therefore, thus says the Lord God, behold, my anger and my fury will be poured out on this place, on man and on beast and on the trees of the field and on the fruit of the ground, and it will burn and not be quenched." God is not pleased when people practice counterfeit religion. No matter what label they put on it, it's still a counterfeit, and it angers God. Let's notice number four, the Beltane. May 1st, the goddess and the sun god marry. The sexual union is depicted and enacted by romps around the phallic maypole. Approximately 9 months later, the birth of the sun god occurs. Hyslop's 2 Babylon reports, "From Bel, the 1st of May is still called Beltane in the almanac, and we have customs still lingering to this day among us, which prove how exactly the worship of Bel or Molech, for both titles belong to the same god, have been observed even in the northern parts of this island of England. The late Lady Baird of Fern Tower," says a writer in the Notes and Queries, "thoroughly versed in British antiquities, told me that every year at Beltane on the 1st of May, a number of men and women assemble at the ancient Druid Circle of Stones on her property near Creef. They light a fire in the center. Each person puts a bit of oat cake in the shepherd's bonnet. They all sit down and draw blindfolded a piece from the bonnet. One piece has been previously blackened, and whoever gets that piece has to jump through the fire in the center of the circle to pay the forfeit. That is, in fact, a part of the ancient worship of Baal, and the person on whom the lot fell was previously burnt as a sacrifice." So again, some of these traditions go back a long way to ancient Babylon. Number five, Litha, or Midsummer. Midsummer because May 1st was considered a start of summer, and August 1st is considered the end of summer on the calendar of the sun, this eight festival calendar. About.com says of this particular festival, the Romans, who had a festival for anything and everything, celebrated this time as sacred to Juno, the wife of Jupiter and goddess of women and childbirth. She is called Juno Luna. The month of June was named for her, and because Juno was the patroness of marriage, her month remains an ever-popular time for weddings. This time of the year was also sacred to Vesta, goddess of the hearth. The matrons of Rome entered her temple in midsummer and made offerings of salted meal for 8 days in hopes that she would confer her blessings upon their homes. Notice number six on the calendar. Lugnasad. Mother Earth is praised for providing bounty. This, of course, comes during the harvest season. And again, a lot of this goes back to Mother Earth. Let's go to number seven. I missed something. Yeah, Mabon is the fall equinox, September 22nd. The sun, God's strength, begins to wane. And then we come to Shamhain, which, of course, is this evening, November the 1st, that is the eve prior. The sun god dies. It is the night of the dead, the time to honor the dark spirit world. And a lot of innocent children will be running around the streets tonight dressed up like dead people, right? And it goes back to this wheel of deception, if you will. Samhain is considered the start of the pagan year, but the winter solstice was adopted as the start of the year by the Romans, which, of course, was the origin of New Year's celebrations. Of course, God says something quite the opposite. In Exodus 12, he says, in the spring of the year is when the year should begin. Like I said, this calendar is based primarily on the sun, and God's calendar is based on the moon. So in conclusion, we've gone through a brief history of the origin of many of the customs and traditions of the world around us for two reasons. Number one is to forewarn God's people about the counterfeits that exist in the world around us. I'd like to go to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. 1 Corinthians 10. And verse 20, 1 Corinthians 10, verse 20. It's easy to find the origins of these days now with the proliferation of information. Like Daniel prophesied, knowledge will be everywhere. And probably while I was sitting here talking about it, some of you have actually gone to your smartphones and you've looked things up. It's all around us. It's not hidden anywhere. The only thing is, our culture today has put a different label on it. They say it's the real thing, but in fact, it's a counterfeit. It's like all those purses I bought for my daughter and her friends. They're counterfeits. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 20. Let's see what God says, 1 Corinthians 10, 20, about such counterfeits. Paul writes, 1 Corinthians 10, 20. What am I saying then, that the idol is anything? Or what is offered to idols is anything? In the world of Paul, the ancient Roman world, the Romans had borrowed the Greek gods. There were gods everywhere. Everywhere. Paul's saying, look, just like the prophet Jeremiah said, can these trees they chop out of the forest, can they do anything to you? No. Verse 20, rather that the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, They sacrifice to demons. The suggestion that people who worship according to the wheel of the eight festivals would be highly offended by that comment, wouldn't they, today? It's not politically correct. But that's exactly the way Paul identifies it in his letter to the Corinthians, probably one of the most perverse cities in the Roman Empire. But that's another sermon. Rather, verse 20, that the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons and not to God. And I do not want you to have fellowship with demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. Go back to the drink offerings. You cannot partake of the Lord's table and the table of demons. When do the great family meals take place? When do the customs and traditions of the meals of the people take place? Eight festivals. They center around. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the Lord's table and of the table of demons. Or do we provoke the Lord to jealousy? Let's go to his second letter to the Corinthians, 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 14. 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 14. I think it's good to remind ourselves, as we do every year, of God's plan through the holy days, to remind ourselves occasionally of Satan's plan through his days that he's established. And Paul clearly identified them. At least he identifies the author of such days. 2 Corinthians 6, verse 14. Do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. Many people say, well, this pertains to people thinking of getting married, where one is a believer and one is not. It could be used in that context, but let's read the context and see what it's talking about. Do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers, for what fellowship has righteousness with lawlessness? What communion has light with darkness? What accord has Christ with Belial, the counterfeit gods? Or what part has a believer with an unbeliever? And what agreement has the temple of God with idols? For you are the temple of the living God, as God has said, I will dwell in them and walk among them. I will be their God and they will be my people. Therefore, come out from among them and be separate, says the Lord. Do not touch what is unclean, and I will receive you. I will be a father to you, and you shall be my sons and daughters, says the Lord God Almighty. We also look at this counterfeit calendar in order to contrast the counterfeit religious story and the model Satan has inspired with the true story and the true plan of God that he's laid out for his children through his holy days. Seven progressing major steps outlining God's plan for man. Not eight solar festivals honoring the God of this world and his demons and his counterfeit system of false gods. So, brethren, as we look at the next 5.5 months towards the spring festivals and the holy days, let's be very thankful for what the true God has called us out of, a counterfeit system, to see his truth and his great plan, so that we're not snared by the great deceiver who has pawned off one of the greatest counterfeits on all of mankind.